Hi, Maya.
Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Today's podcast episode is sponsored by AGS Stainless, fabricated off-site, custom-made all stainless steel railing systems. Why demand prefabrication for your custom rails? Whether you chose cable, glass or rod infill, having the railing system built 100% offsite reduces product cost, improves product quality, and dramatically shortens installation time. For more information, visit agsstainless.com or call them at 888-842-9492. Thank you, AGS Stainless. So I'm here with Maya Salehi of Maya Salehi Studios. Maya is a licensed architect based in California and the founder of Maya Salehi Studio, established in January 2020. Prior to residing in California, Maya spent her early childhood in Iran before moving to the UK for the second decade of her life. Maya's multicultural background informs her diverse design language. Her design philosophy is rooted in the belief that architecture can enhance the human experience through intentional, curious, and deeply collaborative design processes. Beyond her professional pursuits, Maya is committed to advancing diversity and inclusion in the architecture and design industry. Actively involved in mentoring and supporting emerging designers and architects, she is dedicated to creating a more inclusive future for the profession. Welcome, Maya.
Thank you for having me, Michelle. Excited to have this conversation.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Friday is always my favorite day. So I just wake up in a better mood on Fridays.
That's great. So what are your first recollections of experiencing architecture?
So I was born in Mashhad in Iran, and my first recollection of architecture is the house that I grew up in, which I think is kind of also, you know, infuses my love for residential architecture because it tends to be our first memory of being in a built environment. And I remember, you know, my parents, they were students and came from modest backgrounds, and we lived in a rental apartment, but it was still the time where everything wasn't so dense and so curated to, you know, top dollar of square footage amount. We had an atrium in the house that was between, you know, the kitchen and the bedrooms, and was bringing this beautiful natural light from the sky and plants. And I just remember this very complicated and beautiful kind of movement of light in the space, even though I moved out of that house when I was five. And I have these memories of just the quality of that space and being able to go into the kitchen and peek at the bedroom and see if my parents are up, you know, or when the lights would go out, we would just sit around outside of that atrium and just have dinner with a candle under like the moonlight. It was just very, you know, it wasn't fancy. It wasn't luxurious, but it was spaces that were intentional. And I think that that's what I remember the most about my first architectural experience.
Very romantic. Sounds very romantic.
And you know, it was very typical. I remember most houses that we would go to would have a courtyard or an interior atrium. It was very much expected that you have some indoor-outdoor space. And somewhere along the way, that was cut out to maybe add another bedroom, right? So it's less, and you see that less and less, but at the time, we'd go to friends' houses and all the kids, we would be riding our bikes inside the house, like inside the courtyard, very safe. You know, there was no street access or cars. And it was really great to be able to really experience that indoor outdoor lifestyle, without it having being this 1% kind of deal where only a very limited few can afford it. It was accessible to most people when I was growing up.
And then was the apartment on each level there was an atrium?
Okay. Yeah. So So we were, it was like a three-story building. The downstairs, they were the owners and they had a backyard. So the atrium started on our level. And then the level above us, my dad actually was mentioning that he had to go talk to the upstairs neighbors to put a film on the windows, you know, just to, like a frosted screen, because they could look down at our courtyard. So there was a little bit of, there was room for improvement for sure.
Well, that's the way it is with it, right? Yeah. I mean, like even, right, I don't have blinds or anything on my windows, right? But my brother came here to live here for like 1 year, and he immediately had to put a blind on the window in the bathroom, you know, well, I'm tall. And I'm like, nobody's looking at you. Nobody's looking at you. The people next door aren't interested in you, you know?
Right. I like put the window in, and if someone wants to put blinds, they can, but like, don't take out the window, you know, don't take out the
window. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then a lot of times people say, oh, well, we can do, obscure glass. And I'm like, oh, I said, it's a window you still can't look out of, you know, it's just obscure. It's like there is kind of a way that, you know, I mean, yes, I mean, in some cases, like it's fine to use obscure glass, but I mean, sometimes it just drives me crazy, like with obscure glass, because you can't, you know, it is a window, but you can't see out of it. Yeah. Yeah.
I try to avoid it for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, exactly. Just like what you said about how, you know, I mean, you don't, you know, then you don't have a window in your house, right, to look out. And so it's like, you're actually punishing yourself rather than doing anything. You're
limiting your options, right?
You're limiting, yes. The quality of your experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what are three classic buildings that you like and why?
So I think every architect would have a hard time narrowing it down, but I thought I could just focus on Iran, if you don't mind, because that is so much.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think it informed so much of how I think about architecture and spaces. And I don't know if you, did you know about this Roman Empire trend that was going around? Like, what is your Roman Empire? Like, how often do you think about the Roman Empire? And people were saying that like once a week, and kind of it became this entire like scenario that went absolutely viral a few months ago, and people started talking about what it is that you kind of just comes to your mind randomly, like you think about it once a week or some, you know, often place or thought. And apparently men think about the Roman Empire a lot more than we think. But
I don't believe that. I don't believe it, Maya. I don't.
Right. I think they say it just for clout. But I think that these buildings to me are kind of fall in the same category where I just kind of randomly throughout the week find myself thinking about them and the experience of them. And the first one it was kind of hard to choose. There's a city in central Iran. It's called Kashan, and it's a very hot climate. And there are beautiful houses. There are houses very similar. So I picked the Abbasi house to kind of share with you. But there are many similar to that in that specific area. And what I really love about this house is it's so many things. I mean, if you think about like just the hierarchy of the spaces and the way that they define entryways in this region of Iran, you know, when you're walking in the street, you're seeing these very minimal kind of openings towards houses. It looks more like, you know, single story garden walls. And you have really no idea about this scale of what you're about to encounter as you move through this entryway that is, you know, I would say one or two people can get in at a time for the first few feet until you get to that entry foyer, and then it rotates you. So all of that is so intentional too. If you have, you know, this was a time where people would do business from their house and you would be living multi-family, like multi-generations in the same household. And so if you have someone knocking at the door, inquiring for business, you don't want them to see your most private, you know, courtyard in the house. And it's so well integrated into how, you know, there's rotations that you can notice on the floor plan, but when you're in the space, you don't really notice that you've been turned and moved around in this very intentional way. And when you get to this vast kind of courtyard, all around there are these different scale rooms that each serve a function, and they are seasonal rooms. So in kind of that traditional Iranian architecture, you would have like the summer lounge and the winter lounge, and you would have the summer courtyard and the spring room. And so there was so much awareness of how the experience of this house would change throughout the year and throughout the time of the day and in different scales of interactions, whether you have a party or if it's just us, we're not going to be in the same space necessarily. And so I think that's so interesting that, you know, this was built in 1830. Having so many layers of attention to the experience of the user, and that the house is built so that it's lower than the street level, you're kind of going down an entire floor in your entry experience. So, and this is, you know, this is also like the luck of just the soil that is there. It's suitable for being used as a building material. So the way that the house is built is that they excavated that entire ground and then use that soil to make bricks to build the house. So it's the most vernacular architecture you could find. And as the excavation was happening, there's a group of people making the bricks and putting them in the kiln and preparing it for building. And there's things happening at the same time. And there's beautiful ornate decoration everywhere in this building, but it is with the same material. So it's carved brick, carved plaster, mirror work. And it feels very beautiful and visually interesting, but that's only like the surface. It's so well thought through and has held, you know, it's definitely, you know, it's in great condition. It's a hotel now. It's a boutique hotel. And there's restaurants and things that they've made out of the basement area, which used to be the staff kitchen and the cooler room and all that. So I really love that house. And it makes me think about how you can really, you can really think about how people are going to move through the space and in the different times of the year and make that intentional. So that was my.
And then are the spaces geared toward, are the spaces designed as far as, right, it's orientation of the sun.
Yeah, it's orientation of the sun. And, Iranians at the time, I mean, this was in like post-Islam era in the 1800s. And it's like the Qajar dynasty. So they were very religious people. So they cared a lot about privacy for the women if they are unveiled and if they're just like walking around the house and someone comes in. So it's so, you know, it's so much designed for being able to have these like communal spaces and private spaces. And and that there are multiple courtyards, multiple porches on different levels. Every room has an indoor-outdoor quality. There are rooms that have these beautiful sun, moon, crescent mirror work on the ceiling. And it's meant that when you are, you know, there with candlelight, it would create this like night sky above you. It's very romantic and poetic, but at the same time, super functional.
Yeah. It's fine. I was underneath potential clients' like house yesterday, right? Because it's going down the hill, and then I said, "Oh," and she goes, "Oh, well, could we?" Right, everybody, you know how it is. Everybody's like, "Oh, can we dig all this out?" And then, well, I'm like, "Yeah, you can dig it out, but we have all this dirt. We'd have to get the dirt up the hill, and you know, it's probably better if we do it over here." You know, so I think I'm going to suggest to somebody that, like, well, or we could just make bricks out of that. just to see what they say. Yeah. Just see what they say. I'm just going to be like, what? That's
what?
I haven't seen that on Pinterest. You know, it's like, it's
right. And like that level of innovation and labored, you know, and skilled labor, like I don't know your experience, but I have a hard time finding, skilled craftsmen that can do a lot of these ideas that might be a little outside of the norm, you know, but I think that was a great era for that, you know.
It takes a while to train them to do those things. I mean, there's one guy that did work. I mean, I didn't have to tell him that, but then also the client was very involved and had built other things before. And so he was really good with some of the, you know, with some of the details that went, but yeah, I mean, sometimes it's just like, you're just, you're like, whoa, why didn't you ask me about that? Like, why did you do it? And then why did you redo it two times after that and still not ask me about it? But but the contractor that's that does most of my work and is in, he's done work on my house, which is like still right. My project is like still half done on the back wall of my house. But he had done this trim around the door, which I basically had to do a certain way because I didn't want to rip all of the paneling off the wall. So I had just made like a kind of a big, it's like a super trim, right? Like they're really big. But when I first came in and saw it, I said, oh yeah, put the trim around the door. We're going to have to cover up this part. And then it'll just be like this really like, you know, like trim on steroids or something like that. It's in my bedroom. Around these French doors. Mm-hmm. And you know, I came in and I saw, and he had left like these edges on the side. And I'm like, oh, why did you leave the edges on the side? And he goes, cause it's easier to cut them off later than to add them on now. I'm like, you know what? That you are finally learning.
Yeah. The headaches, right?
So what's the second building?
Right. So the second building we're going into non-residential. This is a mosque. It's in Shiraz in Iran, and the technical name is Nesir al-Mulk Mosque. But if you haven't seen it, you can just Google Pink Mosque in Shiraz, and it comes up because it's probably the most famous one. It's not the biggest by any means, and it's not the grandest in terms of even the architecture, but it is the most captivating space that I've ever been in. If there was a space that I could say has really nailed, like elevating your soul, you know, like when you're in there, you feel like you're really having this higher than me kind of experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even religious, you know. I feel like that's kind of what's interesting is that it's a mosque, but it's geared towards, you know, having that religious experience. But you just feel elated to be there. And there's a huge crowd of tourists every morning because it's very much oriented towards that morning sun angle where, you know, people are coming together for morning prayer. There's this vast stained glass windows within these archways that bring in the most beautiful colored light, and the rays are just so dramatic. And the inside has this like deep blue tile on the floor and beautiful pink tiles everywhere. It's just an experience, you know, and I think it's one that makes me feel more courageous with color and with patterns. And, you know, I feel like as contemporary architects, there isn't so much precedence. I don't know about, you know, how to kind of bring a little more soul and life into these very contemporary projects we're doing. And I just keep going back to these, you know, I keep going back to these buildings that I'm like, well, this actually felt good. And somewhere along the way, they try to convince me that it's not. And I don't agree.
I know. It's. And then sometimes, and then when I do have a client that like wants color, it's just like, they're like, it's like too much. And I'm like, okay, can we just like compromise? Like, let's just use this much of it. But you know, sometimes it's like, okay, it's their project, right? It's like, this is what they want. This is what they like. This is what they're going to live in. You know, this is what, you know, they kind of wanted. And I was like, okay, fine. You know, one of my clients was like, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. She wanted this. I think it's, oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say that I think it's, you know, it's not natural to me. Like it doesn't come naturally in my design to like infuse a ton of color. And that's why I'm fascinated by this idea that like there's color on the glass and then the light is doing the rest of the work. Like the inside isn't that colorful other than the one monocolor blue tile on the ground. And so I feel like that's interesting. And then like after that morning sun is gone, the room doesn't have that quality anymore. It just feels very different again. So, you know, to add the architects that designed this mosque, it kind of gives you a little insight about how things worked back then. This one's also from the 18, 1870, I think, was when it was built. The two architects, their names really literally translate to the architect of Shiraz, or like the tile maker of Shiraz, because it was so like multi-generation within the family. It was so much about like learning the trades that get passed down. You know, you're just born into a family of architects, and that's what you do. And you do your apprenticeship, and you pay your dues until you can design your own thing. But I just love the fact that their last name is their trade. And that's, I think, is really, really great to think about architecture as this kind of family, as this kind of family legacy that you're kind of raised to be a part of.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what's the third one? Those are like fairly recent for, right? I mean, like 1870, that's new. Mm-hmm.
Really? Yeah. Yeah. It is. For Iran, it is. Yeah. And I think that's when they allowed themselves to do a little more, have a little more fun with it. You know, I think that era they didn't take themselves as seriously as the guys before. And they were like, it's pink tile, you know, and it was done by,
I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was, right? There used to be the, like pink was a male color.
Yeah. I mean, I think it should be.
Pink was a male color. Yeah. And I think blue was for girls or something like that. It was switched. And then at some point, it's like they switched it and decided that pink was like for girls and not for, you know, I mean, I don't know, but I believe that was like around the 18.
Oh, fascinating.
1800s. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. I mean, I'll look it up and put it in the blog part or something, but yeah. Yeah. It used to be that like little boys were dressed in pink.
Oh, okay. That's awesome.
Switched. So we'll just see. Yeah. We'll just see when it switched and it became kind of like this other color that meant other, right. That was like a more feminine color as opposed to like a more masculine color or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I believe. Yeah. Yeah. And it was it was in England too, that it was like that. That's kind of like when it changed also. So I think like from Victorian time and some part of Victorian. Mm-hmm. So it probably had something to do. I mean, it could have been that it was from.
I think, Iran
and then came to England, right? Because during that time, they became more fascinated with, you know, things from the Middle East and from abroad and from the Orient. Yeah.
I think there was a lot of that. I mean, it's when the trades was like thriving the most in history, right? There was a ton of like the Silk Road being going through Iran. There was a ton of like east to west kind of travel and trade, and people were wealthy. You know, these are all kind of privately commissioned buildings. So you're just seeing this boom of just craftsmanship again, and like taking 10 years to do a building, and, you know, try convincing someone to spend 10 years because you want to hand paint every tile. Like, you know, it's just like a different economy. It's a different time. But it definitely presented some fascinating opportunities.
One of my friends, I'm doing a project for her, and we're doing a ceramic studio and then an ADU on top, but she's doing she's making all the tiles.
Wow.
For her project. So of course she started them like 6 months ago. She started to make them because they're all, I think I have them. I should put them on my website too, because they're all only like this big. They're small.
Oh, that's great. Is it for the exterior or interior?
Interior.
Okay. I thought you're tiling.
Maybe she's gonna put some of them on the interior, on the exterior, but I think it's gonna be mostly. I don't think she's gonna put them all the way around the pool. I don't think she's gonna redo that. I think it's gonna be on the interior and the kitchen area, and then her bathroom area, and then also she's gonna have one of those. She has a hanging fireplace, which of course we're gonna put in after the fact.
Right.
You can't do those anymore. So yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So
great.
And then what's the third building? Did we do three? We didn't do three.
No. So the third building is it's in Tehran. It's Azadi Tower. So it is a building, but it's really better known as a monument. It's in the middle of the biggest kind of I think it's the biggest city kind of roundabout or city square, I guess you'd call it here. It's big. It has a ton of space around it. It's the monument and the landscape. And it's where Iranians have gathered throughout time, like the modern, you know. So a little background, it was built in 1966 or around then. And it was actually a competition. So the, you know, prior to the current revolution, so the Islamic regime is now kind of holding Iran in siege. But before that, before the revolution, you know, there was a king, and they were celebrating 2,500 years of the Persian Empire. So they held this competition to architects to design this monument, and it was called Shahyad, which translates to the memory of the king. And the architect of this structure, his name is Hossein Amanat. He lives in Canada now. He at the time was on his last year of his undergrad program at the University of Tehran. And he was like looking for jobs and, you know, trying to kind of start his career. He saw this competition, and out of his bedroom with a few of his college friends put together a proposal and won. And it's amazing, you know. It's a contemporary piece of architecture that is very much influenced by the history of the people and the architecture native to the area. And what I think is fascinating about it, so it was built as the memorial of the king shortly after there was a revolution, you know, very much anti-king. And the revolution was backed by the majority of the population at the time. I think everyone was holding their breath. Like, is this going to be live on TV? We're going to burn down the king's monument, you know, as a political stance. But people loved it. People loved this building, and they appreciated what it was adding to the city. And despite this kind of extreme political overturn and the fact that this building was directly associated to kind of the king and that political movement, it held its own, and it was protected by the people because it was accepted by them. And I think that is something that I think about often. You know, I think about that, the idea that it kind of went beyond who kind of commissioned it and what it was meant for initially. And maybe if it wasn't so loved, it wouldn't be there anymore. And it's still
an architecture that's able to transcend political, you know, politics. And,
exactly.
Yeah.
And to this day, it's where people gather when they're protesting and have, you know, or if Iran wins the, you know, a football game, it's like, it's just like that place that most big cities have it. Right. And you know, that's the spot to meet everyone. And I just love the idea that it was a very young architect, you know, just kind of went with these ideas. Arup Group actually did the structural engineering for it. And so they kind of brought engineers from, you know, outside of Iran to figure out how to do this crazy geometry, and they made it happen. And I'm fascinated by the courage that took and by how it stood the test of time.
Good. So when did this happen in Iran?
The revolution, 1970.
Yeah.
70. Oh God, people are going to kill me if I don't get this right. I think it was the 75.
Yeah, because when I was in kindergarten, I was in kindergarten in 1969. So that's the reason why I was asking. So there were two kids that lived like a half a block down that had moved there. And I thought that for some reason, their parents were studying here. But they were from Iran. And it was Dariush and Miriam. And so like he was my age, and then she was like 2 years younger, just like my brother and I. And so that's why I was like wondering why. Yeah. maybe they were here because of that. Maybe they went back or something.
It was a multi-year process, right?
So yeah.
The leader, Khomeini, was exiled to Paris. He lived there. and kind of was, you know, kind of leading the revolution from France until the king left and the people were like, all right, come back. And there was a whole ordeal, but that was in 1978. So we've been under this kind of Islamic regime since then.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, you always kind of wonder, like, where do they go? Right. I mean, like I don't know. I mean, I write it on their last name, so I can't look them up on Facebook or something like that. They're, you know,
maybe a little here, bit, Michelle, and reach out. You never know.
Maybe. I did have some person that was, that flew home from, that was coming to visit their sister or something in California. It was he's in Italy, and his daughter was talking about, like, oh, you know, his daughter was like asking him about America. And he's like, oh yeah, I went there when I was like 13 or something. And then he said, yeah, you know, I went on an airplane and there was this woman that was like coming back, and she's like, oh, let's look her up on the internet. And they looked me up and sent me.
That's awesome.
So it's just, I mean, it's like, I see you know, every once in a while or whatever. He's in one of the, it's in Italy, but it's close to the Swiss border. So he's like in the mountains there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. With his family and his wife and his kids and stuff. Yeah. You never know.
You do.
So what do you like about being an architect?
I love designing. I wish I had more time to do that, right? I feel like that's that's where they really got me. I thought that's what the gig is when I signed up. But now
I know, we all wish. Yeah.
Right. I feel like now we have to say, like, I love working. I mean, I do. I love working with clients. I love working. I love building things. I love making things that, you know, last and you can kind of see the fruit of your labor. I think it helps with my once in a while, like, you know, crisis of like, what are we doing on this planet? What are we here for? And then I'm like, well, I'm here to make buildings. And it kind of settles my anxiety a little. But I don't know. I feel like genuinely the times that I'm most excited is when I can close my door at the studio and say, like, I want an afternoon where I can just draw. And I don't get to do that as often absolutely. As I want.
No.
And I don't know if the scarcity of it has made it so desirable for me. But right now, that is it's my motive is to be able to carve out as much time as I can to do the creative process. Mm-hmm.
And I only feel like I can really do it because I work out of my house and I've got people around me all the time, that I can only do it in the middle of the night, which I started doing when the kids were little and they were asleep. And so I would work like these late hours, but I really do feel like I'm the most creative from like 11 to 2.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I mean, they say it's not good for your health. I think if you just sleep in or something until I think that you're at least getting like 8 hours, right? It's like you can try to get 8 hours sleep, but typically, but yeah, I mean, I do just feel like the most creative, you know, being able to like take a concept and like really explore it and go with it. And I feel like a lot of times I'm just limited and I don't really get to do that, you know, mm-hmm. get to really express myself in the ways that I want to. And so that's kind of the way, you know, that's the reason why I think a lot of people, you know, a lot of architects do want to do design build, or they do, you know, create like these beautiful, you know, drawings that really aren't the drawings that we build from. They're just these drawings that, you know, that we would love to be able to, you know,
for our
to,
own hearts.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think it's so interesting you said that, because I find my best work happens late at night as well. And I think that since we've kind of expanded our team and are more in like a studio mode, it's been harder to do that because by the time I get home, I'm pretty much done. But I feel like, I wonder what that's about, right? I feel like it's maybe like the pressure is off. Like it's not a time that you need to be productive or really like you're not on the clock. So I feel like that's an interesting kind of tension between, you know, productivity and billable ratios. And then the creative process is like, it wants to kind of push back on all of that. So maybe, you know, intuitively we're like, this time isn't meant to be productive, so I can actually be creative without my brain saying that I should be like billing hours, you know? So maybe it's that, maybe it's like no pressure.
But when we shouldn't be billing for those hours too. We should be billing for those hours too.
I mean, yeah.
Because that's the real, right? That is the thing. I mean, when people talk about AI and all these other things, it's like, you know what? It's not about AI. It's AI. that was a Freudian slip. But anyways, it's not about the AI. It's about how our brain works and the creative process. And if you read any books about like the creative process, you know, and then across the board, there are many people from different, you know, writers and poets and artists and painters. And, you know, it's like so much of the time it's their creative process about how they do things and like when they're doing them and like how they're arriving at these, you know, at kind of, you know, kind of like this, the product or whatever, how they're arriving at this is very much the same for many different creative professions. Mm-hmm. And
that's fascinating, you know. Right? I, it's something that circles my mind a lot about kind of the culture of the architectural, you know, industry, about us being constantly overworked, constantly like, you know, running out of time and tired and sleepless and all that that you hear about, like this is kind of how we know the culture and it's accepted to be that way. But it's completely against what every, like you said, any kind of creative person who's been successful and you study their work or the way of thinking, it's that kind of lack of or like that space that you hold to not be busy, busy, busy is where you can be creative. So how are we expected to do both, right? And then you end up having offices that have like 100 people just drafting away, and there's two people that have the capacity and the time and space. And then, you know, the kind of the verdict is that only these two people are good at designing. Well, how about you decrease the workload of the people that are doing 60 hours of drafting a week, and maybe they are great designers, but they're burnt out and they can't have the same like creative juices that a principal with, you know, could have with more bandwidth. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I've always worked at small firms, so I don't even know what it's like to work at a big firm. I don't know what it's like to work at a place that's more than 15 people. I mean, I don't know, you know, so it's like, I look at, you know, I was at Patrick Tai's office, last week, and I went to architecture school with Patrick in Denmark, and at that time he was an art major. He wasn't even an architecture major at that time, but you know, I went to his office, and it's just like, it's like this great office, and I just think, you know, there's only like 15 people in there, and I'm just like, oh, like this is great, this is a great space, this is a great office, you know. And I like think, like, would I ever want to be in, you know? And then there's people right in, and you're thinking like, oh, why do you, you know? And then, and somebody from a bigger office was like saying, oh yeah, I would like to get people from their office. I'm like, why would they ever leave his office? I said, I wouldn't leave his office. I would be working there the whole time. I said, I wouldn't leave his office to go and work for your office. I said, you know, it's like, I wouldn't be able to work that many people around or do anything, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was kind of telling, you know, Patrick, I said, you know, it's funny because, you know, and I mean, like Olson Kundig has 250 people in the office, but it's kind of broken down and things. But, you know, Patrick was like, wow, there's 250 people in Olson Kundig's office. And he said, yeah, you know, supposedly. I mean, that's what he told me, you know. So,
right.
So I believe him. But also kind of that Stephen Hall was saying that the most miserable he ever was when he had 75 people in his office. And he goes, there's no way that I would ever have that. He's like, no, I would never have. He goes, I'd rather keep it small, no more than 30, and just like farm out the CDs and stuff to a bigger office, you know, on these bigger projects, you know. And you know, I'm kind of with them on that. I mean, I know maybe the big firms won't like me saying that, but, you know, that's what I feel.
Yeah. And you know, whenever we are looking to hire, most of the people that apply are applying from these bigger firms, and there are, you know, they're burnt out by the culture of the bigger firms. So I do think it's like what we do, it's in the residential world, actually, it's very intentional. You know, like we need to have the bandwidth and the space to think. And then that can't happen. You know, even if you're three people, but you're overworked and like, and you believe that the hustle culture is the right way to go with about architecture. You know, I feel like I know people that, that assume like if you are not losing, you know, sleep and pulling out your hair, then maybe you're not doing it right. And I'm, and I don't know. I don't know if that's, you know, if that's necessarily true and helpful to our process.
Yeah, I know that there's also people like, oh, you know, if you don't wake up at like 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. in the morning or something, like, oh, you're not really working. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I am working. I'm like working all the time. I said, I have my bed, right? I said, if I'm on my phone, I'm working. It's like, I'm not just like sit there. I'm like doing something on my phone. I'm doing social media. I'm like responding to an email. I'm looking up products or whatever. And I said, there's just, you know, it's like, we're always work. It's just different, you know, it's a different work mm-hmm. style. And I think it's fine. I mean, we're making it work, right? We're making it work. I mean, your work is beautiful. There's like nothing, you know, I don't think that you could look at your work and think, God, she's never doing anything. Like, what is she doing?
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. That's the voice in my head. I'm, you know,
I think that some people, like, I've kind of heard, like, when I was younger and I had, you know, and I've told this story before, and I had a baby and, you know, some guy walked up to me at an art opening and it was actually in Michael Filonis's office. And I was running a desk in Michael Filonis's office in Santa Monica, and I had a baby, and there was actually another one of my friends, you know, we became friends, we weren't even friends at the time, and she had her baby. And then this guy like said, oh, so what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm an architect. I said, but you know, I just gave birth. I mean, my daughter was like only a few months old or something. And he's like, oh, he goes, well, what are you going to do? And I said, what do you mean? What am I going to do? And he goes, well, you're not going to be able to practice architecture. But I said, how are you going to practice architecture? And I'm like, well, I'm going to practice architecture and I'm going to raise my baby. And I said, that's what I'm going to do. You know, he's, well, I would never be able to do architecture part time. And I'm like, you don't have to, you can do whatever you want to.
And he probably he probably couldn't handle both, you know. It's like that, you know, in those cases I'm like, well, that's really sad that you can't do both, but I can, you know. All right.
So what would you like to say about the future of architecture?
I think we're kind of on the same kind of conversation. Like, I think the future of architecture, or maybe the present, kind of what I'm seeing or sensing, is I feel like I see less stylistic moves in architecture, you know, rather than being like, well, we're in the era of doing this kind of architecture exclusively, and this is what's in and what's out, and this is what's out. I see less of that. And I think that's great. I think there are so many different types of architects that can each serve, you know, their own clients. And I feel like, again, it kind of lifts the pressure of having to conform to this arbitrary set of rules. And maybe that's across industries, right? All the creative industries are taking a hard look and kind of questioning everything. Like, why are we doing it this way? And as women in architecture, I'm fascinated by how the women's movement and how our approach to our careers and our lives are also changing the way that architecture is experienced. Mm-hmm. And the more we bring minorities and women and people of different backgrounds to the table, it's going to just completely change the way that we think about our built environment and how we shape our environment. And I think it's happening. You know, I'm not typically I feel like I'm a realist when it comes to these things, but I see it, and I think it's kind of, it's kind of, architecture has always echoed what the society has been most concerned about at that time. And I think right now we're at the time where we're just questioning why we were told to do things a certain way, you know, and why we, that there was these certain expectations of what this is and what that is. And when you, when we're in that era, you don't really know what's going to come out of it, but it, I think it would be something more authentic and more true. You know, the people like the, my team, you know, everyone's very concerned about the climate. We're concerned about social justice. We're concerned about things that I heard less about growing into the architecture world. And, you know, even if it's just that we're trying to make sure the materials that we use are a little better for the environment, it's, you know, I mean, we can't change the world, but it's through this, but I think it always echoes what people are concerned about. And it's always kind of like, it's something that you can look back and see what it was, but you can't really see it when you're in it. Right. Like, that's always really great to kind of look back at like what the pandemic did to architecture. Right. I don't think we'll know till maybe 10, 20 years from now. And then we can kind of see the thread of how that influenced it. And, you know, I feel like there, like all this conversation about technology, and I was listening to your episode with Tom, and he was talking about, you know, how rapidly technology has changed through his career of being on Mylar paper. And then now, like, and you know, I established my company in 2020. It hasn't even been that long, but like every year there's like something that, where we want to understand and be on top of, and, you know, we're trying to like incorporate VR into our client presentations, and in doing that, it's like opened up a whole new way of doing client presentations for us that is very much not about the floor plan anymore, you know, because it's like you get to experience it and then you look at the floor plan for reference. So it's changing how I design and think and present. And I think that's going to happen across the board, where our clients are going to demand to kind of experience it before they sign off on it. And maybe that's a good thing. It results in less changes, in less like knocking things down in 5 years and rebuilding, because we had no idea what the ceiling height actually means. You know, like how many times do you hear things like that, where it's like,
what's 10 feet? Yeah. What's 10 feet? Well, what does 12 feet look like? Well, what was that? What's about 9 feet? Well, what about the doors? Like, should we go 7 feet? Should we go to 9 feet? That's that's like ongoing conversation. Right.
And it's always like you're kind of nervous, right? You're like, well, I think this is a good like proportion for this space, but I don't know your psychology and what you find to be great. So we just have this like unwritten kind of agreement that we're just going to roll with what I assume is great. And then hopefully you feel that way in framing and then not want to change things, you know. But now it's like, it feels more collaborative. You know, you want me to try with an 8-foot ceiling? It's a touch of a button, like feel it. Like how does it feel now? And you know, I don't know. I have projects under construction that we didn't have this technology when we were in the design process. And I'm seeing the difference of like, you know, compared to projects that we're right now in schematic design, and how much more comprehensive it could be. So it's changing like year by year. So I don't even know where technology is going. We're just on this.
I don't use VR, but I do have a friend that's in Arizona where they, you know, he used to work for a company. I'm sure that he still has them. I'm sure they still do VR even from his point. But yeah, I mean, they started using it like even before, maybe 2019, 2018 with a lot of their clients, you know. And in some ways, I think that the other thing is that I do think, I mean, people can get some idea with VR, but I do think that unless they're actually in that space, they don't know exactly what it's, you know, it can give them an idea, just like a perspective, just like a rendering, give them an idea. But until they're actually in that space, they're not understanding all that. We can understand it, right? We understand like what that's going to be. And I think that there has to be some level of trust with them that you know, that doesn't always, I mean, I think, you know, I, I think more people should trust their architects to make these decisions to kind of do it instead of it being this fight that they're trying to force them. Like, well, no, we know that this is your first or second house, but we've done like 100 in the last like 10 years or something. Right. It's like, you have to trust us.
Absolutely. And I think you're spot on. Like, to me, like, maybe it's just a little more easy to digest for a homeowner than like a floor plan or a render, but it's not at all like the same experience. But it's kind of like our litmus test, right? It's kind of, mm-hmm. You can get into it and maybe it's not even the whole project, but if there's one area that you are asking, like, do you think this window is too big or too small, or, and to me, there's so much of residential architecture is so subjective. I mean, we work with clients from very, very different backgrounds, different growth. Mm-hmm. And I've done projects where I've gone into the first design meeting and I'm like, I think we should do this like brick perforated wall and it's going to be amazing. And it's like makes so much sense for this space. And my client's like, well, I grew up in a house with a brick perforated wall back in like where I was. And I hated that experience of living in that house. And so that's a like no for me. And I'm like, well, there was no way that I would have ever known that, like, no matter how many conversations we've had. But that's why it's a collaborative process. And that's like, it's always funny to me how everybody has these like things that they really like or really hate. And it's always like, well, of course I really hate this. But then the next hour I have a meeting with a client that absolutely loves the thing that the last hour person didn't love. So, so I try not to be the one that's like, well, this is good or this is bad, because it's, again, it's like, no, I'm your architect. I want to make your vision come true. And I'm going to guide that process to the best of my knowledge, but I'm not going to be like, well, I don't care. Get over your childhood. This is what it is.
Well, I think sometimes, I mean, the thing is that this is like somehow related to this, but one of my friends, they were trying to adopt a child. And so this person, they went into one interview and the person said, and my friend said like, oh, this is my name. And the mom, right, because it was a story where that, they could choose whoever they wanted, said, I hate that name. And so like, so she's like, okay, I guess we're not getting this kid, it's like,
exactly.
I mean, it's like, you just don't know what is in people's heads sometimes. I mean, maybe there are these, kind of like client questionnaires, and it's like, maybe you can add this brick perforated wall to, to like the questionnaire list. I don't use those. Yeah. Sometimes I feel like, oh, maybe I should. I don't know.
Right. And we have a questionnaire that has questions, and I'm always trying not to like bore the clients like too early with this like homework task that is just, go write this down for 2 hours. But we try to ask these questions. But I think what is really awesome about like working with homeowners is that they don't even know a lot of this until it's presented to them. And I think the best clients are the ones that are curious and like interested in that. And they can say never thought about what kind of shower experience, but now I have these like stories, or this like hotel that I went to like 20 years ago had this feature. Yeah. And they're just going to bring in all of these like experiences and stories that enriches the design process and then excites them even more, because they can see the level of input that they can have. And I think that's why I can't see myself getting away from residential. I'm like, I'm too in love with that aspect of it. And I think it's harder to find in other kind of client types.
Well, is there anything else you wanted to say?
I think we've covered a lot. No, I really appreciate this. And I know that we've been wanting to do this since like last July and from the AIA conference, but that just says, how busy everyone is and we are. And I'm glad that we made it happen. And it's been
fun. Oh my gosh. Maya, you know what? I have to tell you, because I said this to the people. So you came up to me after the you know, after you spoke, and then you said, and I said, oh, after you spoke at the AIA CRAN forum, and then, you know, a couple of us were talking afterwards, and we realized that we had all been in Los Angeles at the same time. And then I said to you, I said, oh yeah, I said, we realized that we were all in Los Angeles at the same time, you know, Angie Brooks and the person that's now in Utah, the other person that was speaking there, I forget, her and her husband have a practice. And then there was the other woman that, I know through Lowen that has, I forget her name. Anyway, I'll put it in the blog. But anyway, it was just interesting. We were working at these different offices, and you know, and Jolie Wallace, we were all. And then you said, "Oh, you said thank you for helping to pave the way." And I was so floored. I was like, "Wow, oh, okay," you know, because I'm looking, I'm like, "Oh my gosh, your work is so great! Like, what does she like have to say?" I mean, like, I don't even think that I've done anything in the world to help with that, but. But anyway, I went over to do my my AIA profile thing or whatever, and she started asking about stuff, and I just started crying.
Oh, bless!
Laughing, I was laughing, but I was crying, and I'm like, okay. I said, I know that when you ask me this during the video, I'm going to be okay. Like, I'm not going to be crying when you ask me like that same question that you were just asking me about. And then they did it again. And then I started crying, and I'm like, okay, I hope you can edit that out of the video. Like,
oh my goodness. Well,
when they finally like, they, you know, right. They don't give us a preview of the video that they give. They just like have the video. Yeah. I literally found out when it was posted, and somebody was like, oh, there's this video posted of you. And then that's when I found out what it even looked like. And then I looked at it, and I was like, oh my gosh, like, what did they put in it? You know, so that I'm like, okay, that's good. I'm not crying. So that's what I had put in the note, you know, in the comments or whatever. Oh, good. I'm glad you could edit out my crying in the thing. People are like, what are you talking about? it was very emotional. So thank you. You know, thank you for saying that. And I think
it's from the bottom of my heart when I, and anytime I see women in the architecture business that has been in it longer than I have, I think about like, it would be so much harder for me to be here now had it not been for the women who knocked down those doors, you know, and I can sit here and say like, yeah, there is hardship being a woman in this business, and it is, but I can't imagine how it was in, you know, the like 90s or 80s. I just can't imagine it. I mean, things, I think about that. I think about all the people before me that had the courage and the audacity to say no and to like have a baby and have a job and do that, that then maybe someone now won't ask me like, how are you going to do both? Because they've seen you do it and they see that it's possible. And I think that's really important that we, you know, model it, that it is possible. So yeah. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even the people, right? I mean, Denise Scott Brown, they used to ask, I mean, somebody asked her, like when she went into one of the first interviews, they said, you know, it's like, don't you think that was very unprofessional of him to bring his wife to the interview? Because they didn't realize that even though she's there talking.
Wow.
He didn't realize that she was there as part of the team. I mean, it's just.
Yeah. You know, it still happens at least once a month, someone calls the studio and I, if I'm here, I usually try to pick up the phone and they'll say like, can I speak to the architect? And I'm like, which part of like Maya sounds like a guy? You have to really override the information in front of you to assume that I can't be the architect, but it's fun. It's always fun. You know, I think now we can kind of make light of it because it's not so much of a barrier, but when it was like, I can't imagine the additional mental load of fighting for your right to be in the room. It's crazy, but I hope it gets better, and I think it will.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it will. Yeah. Or like going to an interview one time that I was working for a structural engineer. And so he was sending me to this, you know, any work that came in that was architecture, he would say, hey, do you want to do it? Right. Cause it's not a conflict of interest or whatever, because we don't do architecture here. So I would go and interview. And so one of the things I went and I was pregnant, but of course I wasn't going to say anything about it. And so, you know, sometimes people would ask me like, oh, are you pregnant? You know, because they didn't, you know, because they didn't want to hire me if they saw that I was pregnant. And so they actually asked the structural engineer, they called up and they asked if she was pregnant. Yeah. And so it's like, I tell that story and to people your age, right, that you're like, why would they ever, you know, it's like, that's ridiculous. But then it was just like, yeah, that was just natural for them to say that. They could say that they didn't really care. They didn't think that was outside of their bounds or anything. And then the other thing is that like what I still wouldn't be able to do it just because I was pregnant. And so I would say like, oh, well, my husband's an architect, right? A lot of times I just say my husband's an architect, even though, I mean, he was an architect, but we never did any work together. And so I would just say that. And then they like had this like sigh of relief.
Well, like, if your husband signs this contract, then we're okay. It's like when you get a loan and you're like, well, your credit score isn't that great. But if your husband, but it's like, that's nothing to do. I know. Oh my God. I'm so sorry. When I hear things like that, all I can think is like, I'm so sorry that you've experienced that. You know, I think that we have to remember that was real and that it happened and that your experiences, it was hard and it still is, but we appreciate it. You know, I think we all appreciate it.
Yeah. You know, if we had a strong, right. My mom had bought a house at 21 when she was divorced and went to buy a house later on. She couldn't get a loan. You couldn't get a loan if you were a single woman. Mm-hmm. You know, my grandparents had to co-sign the loan for it. And the realtor who helped her was one of her friends. And she knew which mortgage company was opening and which one would give mortgages to women.
Wow. Yeah. And this is recent history. Like, you know,
I know. Well, this I tell them, like, this is 1975, right? This is 1975. Yeah.
Well, we've made a lot of progress in a short amount of time. So, you know, the sky's the limit. And I want to just be around to see an AIA conference that is more women than men, or like, you know, just, I just want to see it. I just want to be around.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, okay. Well, thank you so much, Maya.
Thank you, Michelle.
And thank you to and thank you to AGS Stainless for their sponsorship of the podcast episode. Thank you.